This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink, inspiring public curiosity about food. Learn more at mofad.org.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, Heritage Radio Network's weekly food news roundup. This week, we're celebrating Black culture through the complicated lens of agriculture. We speak to Carla Hall about her uncompromising soul food recipes.
And I was like, what am I doing? Why am I changing my family's history for another culture?
We also hear from Gabriela Rodriguez at Harlem Grown's Youth Farm Uptown.
About empowerment and, you know, community resilience building through this work. Food is kind of just a vehicle.
Leah Penniman addresses feeling like an outsider in the farming community.
I could count on my two hands the number of people who appeared to be POC, people of color. And so I literally would go around little slips of paper and say, hey, meet at 1 o'clock under this tree so we can talk.
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network. That's Meat plus sign THREE, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Food Without Borders, a show about food, politics, and identity. I'm your host, Sari Kamen, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Today, I'm in the studio with Nikki Marcellin. Nikki is the chef and founder of Epicurious Safari, a bespoke boutique food experience company. Epicurious Safari focuses on providing unique experiences for clients while showcasing flavors of the Afro-Diasporan tapestry. Welcome to the show, Nikki.
Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. It's cold.
It
got really cold all of a sudden.
It's very cold. It's freezing outside, but yeah. You hopefully didn't have to travel too far.
No, I didn't. I took an Uber.
Good for you.
I abuse the Uber sometimes. Yeah. Which I'm rocking like a 50% off thing right now, so...
Well, we can't blame you because it's about 3 degrees, which is nothing like where you grew up.
Yes, nothing like that at all.
You're from Haiti?
Yes, I'm from Haiti. I was born in Port-au-Prince. So like my dad worked in America, but I was born in Haiti. So I had like, I'm a U.S. citizen with like a birth abroad. But I grew up there and my parents sent me to school there. So like a lot of my formative years and me getting to know and recognize like different things in society, was spent in Haiti. So yeah. What else do you want to know?
I mean, I'm just curious, what was life like in Haiti? Like what did you eat there? What was your school like?
Okay. life was great. Life was amazing. I think like when you're little, you think like, oh, it could be so much better. Mm. But compared to other people, I think I had it very well. Growing up, I got to come to America or go to France or Canada for like spring break or December, like, you know, Christmas. During the summers, I would go spend like summers in like the village where my grandma and my mom grew up and just sort of... just chill. It's still the same as I remember it when I go back now, and it's just so refreshing to like knock me back down to earth and get to know all those things. So a lot of like my food identity and who I've become and like my love for food and preparation and just different practices came from those summers, because I just remember making different things with my grandma, making different things for my dad. Like, I remember one of like my vivid memories is making my dad goat stew at like 8, and it came out well. It came out well. The flavors were good, but
I mean, how discerning were you at 8 years old?
I was pretty discerning. Yeah. I think like my mom is classically trained, and my dad has a really refined palate, and everyone in my family are sort of cooks. So I think it was great, and it was like the reason it wasn't like as good, and somebody needed to go in and fix it, is because I didn't realize that. Oh.
goat is very tough. You swear. Yeah. This is why, like, I was like, oh, I don't have papaya leaves. That's fine. Like, I can just stew it down slowly. But that's sort of to break down, like, the enzymes help break down the tissue. But it was great. And I think that's one of my wildest memories. And I think I just sort of remember just loving cooking and loving making something for somebody else and having them like appreciate it. And that's a lot of our culture. So yeah.
Did your mom teach you how to cook? Like, do you have memories of being actively taught?
No, I actually don't have any, like, I have memories of being in the kitchen, and watching like my parents cook, like watching my grandmother cook, my aunt cook. But like I would always go off somewhere. But if I needed to like make myself an omelet, like theoretically I knew how it happened. So I think it's just sort of like they say like children learn when they're in the womb. So yeah. I think I just sort of inherited those because my mom's a pretty great cook.
And you learned through osmosis.
Yeah, I think I learned through osmosis. And also like, another reason why I say I've always been in love with food. My mom always like tells the joke, and my mom and my grandmother tells the joke about how when I was little, they would go into kitchen and just like my teeth mark would be on everything. So like the onions, like carrots, like tomatoes, and like just like bite them because I just wanted to know what they tasted like and what they were like. So like everything they were cooking with, like I put my mark on it.
That must have been annoying for them, but that's pretty adorable.
She thinks that she now says it's adorable, but I don't know. That might have been annoying for me. Go for the tomatoes and like it's like a little too little.
I like that. You're curious. Marks.
Yeah. So I just like remember that and mixing spices. When you're in Haiti from a young age, like, if you're from like a cooking family, you start learning about just like flavors and how to like layer them and how to just sort of make things happen and make flavors happen and all that stuff. Because when we were little, we would be in charge of like cleaning rice or making the spice, like making the marinade. So like your job was to gather everything, wash them, and then like make the marinade and like a mortar and pestle, very old school. And that's still how, like, when I go to Haiti, we do it. Like here, I just use my food processor, but and then just like mixing different spices and learning about all these things. So yeah,
I love that like having an understanding of like what spices go together to create different flavors is like a part of your education.
Yeah. So from a young age, that was something that happened. From a young age, I was learning how to make like different liquors, like which is kind of weird.
Awesome.
Yeah, kind of awesome. So I learned, it was like when my grandpa died, and Haiti is like, we have a lot of traditions, but then there are some traditions that just sort of no one really practices anymore. But funerals are one of those things that like we really go in for and care about, and like we send people off like with a bang. And food plays a big part of it. Like goats are slaughtered and like rice comes in and like half the town is invited and people fly in and like it's like a 3-day affair and everything is made from scratch. Like fresh bread is being made like from the minute the person is like in the morgue. And one of my memories is making like different type of liquors with my grandmother. So like hibiscus and like cherry, and making cremas, which is sort of like coconut with milk, reduced down sugar, and it has like overproof poured into it, as well as rum, a little lime zest. Like, so I just remember making those things and trying it and being like, oh, it needs more alcohol. Yeah. It needs more of a punch. And so those things, I sort of had like an informal education, but also at the same time formal, because my mother was making like puff pastry in front of me when I was like 10, 12, and 4 or 5. it was making different things. So like one of the first things I had to learn how to make was rice. And my mom will tell you, I just perfected it, her eyes, even though I think I've always had a pretty good handle on it, but in her eyes, I've just perfected rice. So that's a big compliment.
Well, I love the idea that for funerals, everyone starts cooking things from scratch, because mm-hmm. I feel like here with funerals, you know, no one would ever really
stop by the shop stuff.
Right. I mean, like I've been to funerals and it's like that. It's like you just get packaged, whatever, because I don't think people give themselves permission to create anything for a funeral, because that feels like you want to make that effort when it's like more of a celebratory time, like Thanksgiving, like everyone starts cooking and you know, you really go in. But for funerals, it's like that would maybe feel too indulgent and not appropriate for the time. But in fact, I mean, that makes so much sense that you would want to create something in this moment where you're, you know, acknowledging that someone else has passed.
Yeah, I think it's a way for people to just allow themselves to send the person off. Mm-hmm. Cause I know like my uncle, my grandmother did not have a great relationship with my grandfather, but like they still allowed themselves to do that. And that's their own way of just sort of letting that person go. So
I can see how it would be very therapeutic.
No one really cries until you're at the cemetery. And then when you get there, you know, people do their crying thing, and then after that you leave and you go to the after thing, and people are just eating and it's just like normal, and people are like, bring on the whiskeys. Haitians love their Black Label. It's it needs to change. I'm just like, but Haitians love whiskey and scotch. It's
good to know. I'm sorry I didn't bring any.
No, it's fine.
So tell us about when you left and why you left.
I left permanently because I had been coming back here back and forth since I was little. I left permanently to come to school, like 12 or 11-ish, because there was a lot of sort of unrest in Haiti with Aristide and all those different things. And just kids from a certain type of families were sort of being kidnapped, and my parents were like, all right, it's time. Although
were you from a certain kind of family where you were
vulnerable? We were definitely targeted. I went to an all-girls private school. Like, we had drivers, like we lived in a certain neighborhood, so people see that as a certain way. Mm-hmm. But so with all that happening, and I think one day something happened with like me getting picked up from school, and then my mom heard about it, and then she was just like, all right, we like you. It's time that you like, you know, really take advantage of this citizenship, and it's good, instead of coming just straight for college, you can just come like before college and just get those formative years in here. And it was such a culture shock when I moved here permanently, because when you're on vacation, it's all fun, you know. Sure. You're here for 2 months. It's
what was the most shocking part of it?
I think I always tell people the most shocking part of it was people make a big deal about the fact that you're Black.
Where did you move to?
I moved to New York, and then I didn't go to school in New York though. My mom lived in New York, and I went to school in boarding school in Connecticut. So,
which is a pretty white place.
It's very white.
From what I hear.
So I'm sure like a lot of people listening are just, what's with her voice? I've gotten like, are you from California? A lot from different people, but it's just sort of, I kind of picked it up because I went to New England for school and then stayed for high school.
Was that an effort? Was that strategic that you
It was strategic. It was, I asked to go.
No, that you, I mean, it sounds like you had an accent when you moved, and then at some point.
It was definitely a way of coping. Mm-hmm. And it was definitely a way of just me like putting on that cloak, and just sort of assimilating, which I am learning, when I'm slowly learning now, that I don't have to. Mm-hmm. And I'm okay like being in the space that I am. So, and for a while, that in itself like changed my identity with like myself, as well as like my relationship with food and the way I looked at it and what I deemed good. Like suddenly I went from the kid that would never like eat at McDonald's, right, to someone that was just like, oh yeah, I'll go to McDonald's because everyone's going and that seems like the thing they're doing. And I didn't want to like pack my lunches anymore. And
so in order to fit in,
you kind of changed
your standards.
Yeah. But that only lasted for like 2 years. I'm very much an individual in that sense that I get bored when I start like following what doesn't feel right to me, and to like my true essence, like, for a while. So I just kind of reverted back to myself and I didn't care. And I would make rice and beans and pack it and all that stuff. And that's just followed me through college. And I also attended college in Providence. So I could have left.
Did you feel like you had to explain yourself a lot? And was food helpful in that way? Or did it make you feel more ostracized because you were eating things that were different and you were showing up with rice and beans instead of eating McDonald's? Was that useful to you because you were like, this is who I am and I'm happy about that and I have this like mechanism to express myself? Or did it make you feel like you stood out further?
I think it made me feel like I stood out, but I didn't care. And I had a problem with the fact that like I didn't care. Like I'm just like, I could care a little more about what they think. But in relation to that question, the school that I went to had a restaurant program. Like if you decided to take cooking for the first 2 years on your third year, you could, like, there was a bistro in the school that like it was student run, and you would be in these groups of five and you would come up with a theme or a restaurant concept, and that like you would develop that over the term, and then when it came to your time you would formulate the menu. So I think during that time it was really hard because I wanted to serve like the food that I knew, and I wanted to show a little part of myself. But everyone, we would pick recipes out of like cookbooks, so everyone was like heading towards Martha Stewart and like Food Network and all those things, and I would just be like, I don't want to cook that. Like I don't want to cook that. I just want to like, I want flavor, and I want like, why can't we make like stew? Why can't we make like black bean soup and all those things? I'm like, at this point, I'll even settle for like American Southern food. Like, but even that was a problem because, the people whether in my class or in my group saw black Southern food a certain way. So if we wanted to do that, it would be like mashed potatoes with a lot of butter and cream and like fried chicken and maybe like greens and like sauteed greens, and you would serve that. And then they couldn't figure out like something vegetarian. So it would just like be like a one-off menu. So even that in itself, I started questioning, and I'm just like, there has to be more. Cause I know my culture and I know my heritage, and it's very strong and deeply rooted. But then I came here and I was just like, for a long time, the rest of the world, like we think that America does not have a culture because it's sort of a melting pot and you guys don't have a just sort of food heritage sort of. But I'm just like, but then I started thinking like, well, hot dogs, hamburgers, that is a food culture. Yes, it's kind of, you know, just one off, but it is a food culture. And it was really onto me to start discovering like, what is Southern food about, and who are the people contributing to it, and why is it not in like the forefront of things now that in 2019 Southern food's starting to become like at the forefront of the food movement. But like then it was just really, really rare to find somebody that was just like doing it and doing it right. And also like at that time it was kind of a bad word. to be like Haitian. Like, people didn't even know where Haiti is. Yeah. Haiti was. Like, I got that question a lot. Like, oh, you're from Haiti. Is that like in Africa?
Wow.
I'm just like, no, it's in the Caribbean. Even now, like, some people still don't know. Like, somebody was talking the other day and they're like, Haiti? And I'm just like, yeah, it's in the Caribbean. If you're thinking that's where it is, that's where it is. So now I think people are starting to embrace our cultures more because it's sort of mainstream, and we have like rappers that are Haitian, and like Rick Ross shouts us out a lot. And like, because he has Haitian friends, and there's sort of like a little microcosm that's growing with, you know, like within like the Haitian community, where like the Haitian artists are just really starting to do their thing and putting themselves out there, putting themselves mainstream. Whereas like they're not just known to us, so people know where it is. And then the earthquake that happened really put us on the map. So, but when I was in school, it was hard. Like, I never got bullied, because I always tell people that I never got bullied. I'm a certain type of person. Like, I think somebody threatened to bully me once, and I was like, all right, it's me and you.
like, let's go.
We're not doing this.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna like be miserable for like 4 years because you want to make yourself feel good.
Yeah.
But being Haitian was like a reason why people bullied you. Like,
sure.
You know what I mean? It was just like, oh, you have AIDS since you're from Haiti.
Oh, and my God.
Like, I'm like, do you know how HIV is transferred?
Clearly
like,
not.
Yeah, so.
Kids are so dumb, though. I mean, they'll, kids like, use any excuse, like, anything that feels other. You know, they're like, what is the dumbest thing I can say about this?
Very dumb. so just even, like, my African friends that went to my school, like, even for them, it wasn't that easy, because people would just be like, African booty scratcher and, like, all these things. And it was just like, no. Like, do you talk to your mother with this mouth? Like, don't know. Like, you don't even know our culture. And just sort of the ignorance behind it. Like, I've been at, like even now I still get asked, like, two or three years ago, somebody was like, you're very articulate. You say you're from Haiti? And I'm just like, yeah. And they're like, huh. So, like, did you go to, like, an English school? I'm like, partially. And then she was just like, oh, okay. You know, like, a lot about, like, I was working at a fine dining restaurant then. And she was like, you know a lot about, like, just this sort of stuff. One, I got trained. Two, I lived like in a McMansion when I was in Haiti. So, like, whereas now I live in like an apartment in Brooklyn. So that is the most ignorant question to infer or even say to somebody, that you think they were like just making food from a hut. And
like, right. But all people know is what they've seen.
People know is what they've seen.
I mean, and I'm not defending them. I'm just saying, like, that's the images that come to mind are like war-torn, you know, starving children. And it's like, well, that must be everything.
So that's either, there's like two extremes, right? When people think about Haiti, it's either like, oh my God, I was on the Carnival cruise. I like stopped at Labadie. It was amazing. And I was like, do you know that Labadie's like, it's rented, like we rented it out, and even like our vendors are not allowed to step foot in there. And that's why like you probably didn't see a lot of Haitians. So that's not a true representation of
Haiti. Also, if you're going on a cruise, maybe you're not having the most authentic travel experience.
Yeah.
Okay.
And even to kind of put my Haitian brothers and sisters out there a little bit, when they go to Haiti, they show like, they're like, I think they do it with like a kind of good heartedness. Like, oh, I want to show what this country is about. So they'll go to like the resorts, and they'll go to like the beach clubs and all that stuff, and just show like beautiful water. But there's like an in between, right? That just sort of like movement, that everyday movement, like the market.
Real people,
like the children, like kids going to school in their uniform. Everybody wears uniforms in Haiti. Even if you're in a public school. So like kids going in their uniforms, like you can spot who goes where, and you know if you have like beef with their school. So like just there's like beauty in that. And you know, like at 1 o'clock or like 12:30, like, oh, everyone's gonna start, like the streets are gonna start smelling like food because that's like our dinner, and everyone's gonna start like putting their food out on the table, and kids are coming home from school, and then they're gonna go to lessons. Like, I find beauty in that. I don't think a lot of people showcase that. Like, yes, there's not electricity all the time, but like some of us have like generators, and just sort of like that beauty and just like hilariousness. When I go to Haiti, like, I'm always just like, I'm not doing this. Every time I go, I always threaten that the next time I go, I'm going to stay in a hotel. But like, I always go back to it because like, I love that. And especially going back home to where like my grandmother's from, it's like, it's a town, but it's a village and it's small and everyone knows each other. And everyone knows that like, I'm Alta's daughter. And I'm like, oh, like, that's like this person's granddaughter, and everyone knows stories of my mom that like my mom doesn't even remember because they've been there like forever.
It's community.
Yeah, it's community, and these just like people have built collaboratives with themselves without knowing that it's a collaborative. Like, when I was younger, my grandmother lived in this giant, like, it was like a giant plot of land, and there was like multiple families that lived in it, and they were all separate families, but everyone ended up family, you know what I mean? Like, people supported each other, people knew what was happening. Like, people, when they went to the market on a Saturday, because like Saturdays are like a big market day where like all the wholesalers come out and they like sell their stuff to the smaller vendors. So there's like beauty in that, like people just creating and surviving without even knowing what it is. Like, on Sundays, you'll cook for yourself and your family, like a giant meal and like a nice Sunday like meal. And then you have like people bringing you like 3-course meals themselves. Mm-hmm. So you end up having like 6 different types of meals because people are just like, oh, it's Sunday, I have to like feed my neighbor. Even when it's not Sunday and people cook and they see that you haven't cooked, like, people take the time to like put a bowl of food together and like close it and like bring it to your house, within that like space and that compound. I don't want to call it a compound because compounds are like associated with like weird to me. When I say compound, I'm just thinking like Mormons and like one husband.
I don't think we took it that way. Okay. Nikki, we're going to take a quick break and hear from the sponsor, and then let's come back and talk about Epicurious Safari.
All right. Awesome.
This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. Featuring a variety of interactive displays, MOFAD encourages eaters of all ages to be curious about food. The museum currently operates MOFAD Lab, a 5,000-square-foot experimental space in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where Chow, making the Chinese-American restaurant, is currently on show until the end of March 2019. This exhibition celebrates the birth and evolution of Chinese-American restaurants, tracing their nearly 170-year history and sparking conversations about food culture, immigration, and what it means to be American. It highlights the evolution timeline of Chinese-American restaurant menus, dating back to 1910, and also highlights a tasting section where participants get to enjoy tastings created by the country's most talented chefs who specialize in Chinese-American cuisine. Make sure you check out Chow while you still can. The exhibition closes at the end of March 2019. Check out MOFAD's tastings and extensive event calendar at mofad.org/events.
Hey, you're listening to Food Without Borders on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sari Kamen, and I've been chatting with Nikki Marcelin. She is the founder of Epicurious Safari. So we haven't talked about that yet. I want to hear what that is.
Okay.
And you did go to culinary school.
Yeah, I went to Johnson Wales.
Yeah.
Woo.
And I know you worked in several like Michelin starred restaurants.
Yeah.
And
both front and back.
Okay. And you know, I kept getting this theme as you were talking about how you were like, I'm cooking what I'm supposed to be cooking, but yeah. like what I really want to be cooking is Haitian food. So I'm guessing that feeling kind of stayed with you through your experience in culinary school and then in the different restaurants you worked in and probably maybe even led you to decide to start your own company, I'm guessing.
Yeah. So in culinary school, I sort of like during just like a test day, like I got just sort of the wind knocked out of me because I was asked to make snapper the way I would make it back home. But like I went in, I filleted it. I did like all this like fancy stuff that I had learned like over the summer at like Jean Georges. And I was just like, all right, like this plate shows like who I am and I'm growing and I'm like moving up there. And I go to the table and he tastes it and he was like, this is trash. I was like, what? He's like, it's good. It tastes like I would make it. It doesn't taste like what you would make or what your mother would make. And I was like, well, I was trying to stick with the status quo and what I've been learning. And he was just sort of like, do what you know. Mm. Use what you're learning here as a tool or like as a seasoning on top, but like do what you know. And I sort of carried that with me throughout. And then working in a restaurant and like just Michelin star restaurants, like everything is just very like precise and cut out. I started cooking a lot of things and people would come and they would explain a dish to me that I'd have to like prepare certain facets for. And I'd just be like, wait, isn't this like this dish from this country, but it wouldn't have that name. And it wasn't made that same way and the flavors were kind of off. And I wanted to bring that same like soul and flavor and punch to with the techniques that I was learning. So very like still the things that I had learned since I was little to now and bringing the techniques that I've had been learning. So like bringing in like a few modernist techniques and a few like different things like just like plating beautifully and how to like match like the flavors of garnishes and all that stuff. I wanted to bring it in and tighten it up and show the world that just Caribbean food and like African food and just food from like the diaspora in general could be beautiful. Like, and I could teach and I could feed you like chicken hearts, like that's full of flavor, full of bite and with the flavors of my home and you would love it. And yes, like you might look at it and just be like, oh, I never had before, but you've had it, you know, you've paid like $30 for it at like some restaurant. Like you've had bone marrow, like we're still doing those things, but we're using it like in like sort of a ragu and we're putting like dumplings in there and adding like just like bites of plantains and fresh tomatoes and all these fresh ingredients and backing it up and serving it. And you get sort of that experience. I'm just presenting it to you in another way and possibly full of color. And I'm just allowing myself to be like very cocky about my food and what I cook and what I bring to the table. Yeah. So that's how it came about. Epicure Safari was like a senior project actually. And then I just sort of kind of
name.
Yeah, thank you. Safari means not like safari going to the jungle and like shoot animals, but safari means journey.
Yeah.
So it's just sort of encompassed like my journey as a gastronome, as a epicurean, as a person who loves food. And
so
like travel.
What is it? Is it like you do pop-ups?
We do pop-ups. And we also do like private dinners, that are experiential. So you tell me what you like, and then we bring that in.
So when you say totally we, different. I mean, do you have other people, or is it like
I have like one-off people okay. that I use?
We're not there yet.
No, that wasn't like a judgment.
No. I know that. Just like we're not there yet. My goal is to like fire myself from every job. Yeah. I don't want to do my newsletter. Like I don't want to do my website. Like that is the goal. But I started Epicurious Safari. It's full time in July to sort of fund another project that was actually my real thesis in college. So that's what I'm currently working on. And that just gives me the freedom and the time to just run around New York and meet with different people and go to like networking events and like meet with
VCs.
Do you
want to tell us what that project is, or is yes. that a secret?
So it's not a secret so much more, because in order for me to like get advisors, I need to start speaking about it. So it is a production studio that is also an incubator space and a co-working space for people within the hospitality and food industry and beverage. So the intent is to have a building where that all encompasses, and the public can also come in and have first hand knowledge of what is happening within their space. And there will be classes that are held for people within the food industry. So we're gonna be starting the branding is still working. Like when that is up, you'll see it on my Instagram. But we're going to be doing clinics of things that will be happening. We also plan on having a residency kitchen that people can come in and like spend a residency for 6 months if they're not really sure about what their restaurant concept. And like, we'll have an incubator team that's really gonna be behind them and helping them develop their team and develop their idea and get stronger within that. So it's going to be cheaper than like renting a space within New York, because it's in their building. And then you'll really get to build like your target audience and market and all that stuff. So in a kind of safe environment, and there'll be like a production studio, commercial kitchens for rent that you can either lease for a certain amount of time. And yeah, all your hot and cold stuff will be included in that. I'm working really hard on the financials so that it doesn't have to be separate, like the way other places are. And from there, yeah, it will have like a photography / sort of studio like this, where people can come and do their podcast or shoot their do their R&D and shoot their photos and meet with different beverage people and beverage labs that like people can really test and get to know each other. So the whole goal for the name is Lister. It's Lister is a market when you're going to my town in Haiti. The whole goal is
Do you know
to
where
build,
it's going
to
be?
I don't know where it's going to be yet.
Okay.
That's why.
The it plan just sounds is like an enormous York. Undertaking.
It is very enormous, but that's why I'm kind of like that. yeah. I decided to, I mean, I think I can do it. The whole goal for it is to not I think I know I can do it. The whole goal there is to build like VC, so that's what I've been really working on and really like focusing on that process. And it's hard, but I know it's a journey that I want to take and I'm like intent on tackling. So better to have try than not try at all, right?
Yeah, got
it. So I'm very excited about that. And I know like a few people that I'm working with are very excited about it also. But it's a space for us to, because there's not really a co-working space for the freelancers in our industry. And even me, who's like a private chef, doesn't really have a space to like do R&D and like really have like the kitchen size or the fridge size. So you get all that, and you get the opportunity to build relationship with like farmers, build relationships with other people within the industry. So it's an opportunity to build community, create and foster like creativity, foster more learning and engagement, and just sort of bridging that gap between like, oh, I'm pastry and you're savory and mm-hmm. like I'm only beverage, when in general we all kind of like it all intertwines, you know.
Well, in the meantime, why don't you tell us where we can find Epicurious Safari?
EpicuriousSafari.co on Instagram also. I will be posting a list of events that we're
doing one-offs of for the summer. So we have like a brunch series coming up. We have a bites series coming up. So that's just like a small fee that you pay and you get to just munch on different things I'm working on in my test kitchen. And like it'll be paired with one cocktail or like one wine for the night. And that's really cheap. And you can also hire me for your next event. I'm doing elopements right now, so if you don't want to do it in a restaurant and you want to have the food that you want to have.
Wait, elopements?
Yeah, so people are eloping more than doing like traditional weddings, and when they elope, it's not that they don't want to spend money. They hire photographers, they get the pretty dress.
They just don't want their family there.
Yeah, so why not continue the trend and hire me to like do your meal for you and your closest friends? And,
I love that.
And you don't have to really, you know, nobody, I used to work in restaurants, we have to kick you out after like 2 hours and a half. That doesn't have to happen. You still pay the same type of money that you would pay, and you probably get more booze, and you can just booze in your space in your home and just be more comfortable. So
that's it. Everyone start eloping. Call Nikki. She's
call
got
me.
You.
And yeah, for your next bachelorette party, your next dinner. And then you also will get like a full taste of my heritage and what I have to offer and bring representing what you normally have in just new spirit and new picture and vibe.
I love yeah. it. Mm-hmm. Well, Nikki, thank you so much for coming on the
yeah,
show.
Thank you so much
it's
for
a
having
pleasure.
Me.
Best of luck with all of your incredibly ambitious, amazing sounding projects.
Thank you.
Thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Find us next week, Wednesday, 6 p.m. at heritageradionetwork.org, and check us out on iTunes and Spotify and Stitcher.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.